Hi, I'm Ross Reynolds. It was a huge thrill for me to interview one of my literary heroes, novelist Kurt Vonnegut, on September 13th, 1990. He was 67. Vonnegut's dark satires, Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, were hugely influential to me and many others who came of age in the 1970s. The books were simultaneously grim and hilarious, as was Vonnegut in our interview. He had just published his 12th novel, Hocus Pocus.
Laughter and tears are physiologically have the same purpose, is to get rid of things in your bloodstream which have made you ready either to fight or to run. And so when you go boo-hoo or you go ha-ha, you throw off these useless chemicals from your bloodstream. And I said I prefer laughter because there's less cleaning up to do afterwards and you can go on about your business that much sooner.
Why does it get harder to laugh?
Because there's nothing funny about it, and there was nothing funny about the planet when I was born. But I was able to get considerable relief from laughter, and I still do. I'll laugh many times today. But I really do not find this a funny place.
How much of that do you think comes from a person's personal life, from adversities in a personal life, rather than how the world looks different?
Well, the world is in very rotten shape now. There are many things that are awful about modern times, but one is that we have information.
Too much?
Yes, because the news is truly horrible. Is 100 years ago, we really had no idea what sort of shape the atmosphere was in. We didn't know how many people were on the planet, and a lot of them we hadn't found yet. And we know all about it now. We finally have an inventory, and the place is a mess as a biosphere.
Well, as I read this book, I was thinking this is the product of someone who's laughing just to keep from crying because it's a very pessimistic book about humanity.
People think that is a spiritual matter or a matter of character, and it's not if you hang around with scientists, you know, or you read the back pages of the newspapers. The news is really bad, and I can't see that a sunny disposition is much help, particularly Ronald Reagan's, for instance.
Did he give sunny dispositions a bad name, though? There are scientists who are very optimistic, who see spiritualism in science, who see nature as vindicating their spiritual beliefs even.
Oh, well, it may. As Jung said one thing, is that nature can't make a mistake. Whatever happens, happens, and that's nature. But I think on the basis of my conversation with scientists about the water and the atmosphere and all that, that we're just about done for, is that it's like guppies in a fishbowl that isn't well taken care of as they wind up on the surface. Mm-hmm. I think, and I've said too, and I say in this book, that I think so many people, there's so little interest in conservation, in saving the planet. I think most educated people realize how much trouble we're in. If secretly, they don't give a damn whether it goes on or not, because they find themselves so embarrassing. It's because they can't dance or they can't make love enough or whatever. Of course, we have the standards of Hollywood of what life is supposed to be like, and we all fall very short on that. But I think we are so embarrassed, we should all be embarrassed by Auschwitz and by atrocities. And one atrocity I put in the book here is after the slave revolt of Spartacus, these were slaves who didn't want to be slaves anymore, and they were led by a gladiator. 6,000 of them were crucified, and 3,000 on either side of the Appian Way. So we don't have to talk about the hydrogen bomb or Auschwitz or anything else. We have always been really terrible animals.
Well, your character as a professor, Eugene Debs Hartke, says some of these things to his class. It makes him an unpopular professor, at least among the powers that be at the school he teaches at.
Well, he's been spoken to and finally fired by the Board of Trustees for making the students pessimistic about their country, for questioning the quality of the leadership and all that. Mm-hmm. And God, it certainly is right to question the leadership, which would lead us into the Vietnam War and find no way to get back out of it.
You've written about how this problem to laugh as you get older kind of overtook you while you were doing a college lecture tour, and you really had to cancel the rest of the appearances on the tour.
Well, what I said on the tour, and I try to be candid with that's usually students and tell them the truth, just as though I were a teacher, and what I said to them, which I think is true, is that the environmental problems we face are more terrible than the rise of the Nazi Party. If I have a German name, my ancestors have been over here since before the Civil War, but if my ancestors had remained in Germany, I wonder what I and my brother and my sister and my mother and my father would have done about the rise of Hitler. And I think very little until it was too damn late. And what is happening to the environment now is catastrophic, and not very many people are deeply concerned about it, mm-hmm. Or likely to do anything about it until it's too damn late.
Do you have to wrap that message in humor to get it across to people?
No, I was saying it didactically from the stage, and then all of a sudden I said to myself, my Lord, these people just got here. Mm-hmm. You know, they've just become educated, or in the process of getting educated, and to tell them such a terrible thing, I didn't want to do it. Here I am doing it again, but I don't want to discourage them. I want to encourage them, but it seems to me the news is so awful. It's hard for me to shut up about it.
Well, with this profound pessimism, why do you want to write books?
Well, for one thing, it's how I make my living, and for one thing, it's a gesture. And it's the same sort of thing I would have done if I'd been of the proper age in Nazi Germany. I would have made a gesture, although it was obvious that everybody was nuts about the swastikas and the bonfire marches and all that, and marching in the Poland. I would have said something anyway, mm-hmm. even though it was hopeless. And so that's what I do. I crack off, even though the forces are so enormous, many of them historical, we have inherited a planet in rough shape, you know. It isn't as though we did it all ourselves and should be ashamed.
There's a scene, and I think it's Stardust Memories, the Woody Allen film, where mm-hmm. he, as the filmmaker, is walking around worried about the state of the world and wondering what to do. And a spaceship lands, and the aliens come out of the flying saucer, and he asks them, what should I do? And they just say, make funny movies. They just tell him, just go ahead and make funny movies.
That's about it. And I think the very best thing to be is a musician. And music gives such relief, even though there's not much else you can do about it. But I've said often that this country did not go fascist or become a dictatorship of some sort during the Great Depression because of the comedy and of the music, both of which were free coming out of these wonderful little boxes, radio. All you had to do is turn them on. And the level of comedy was superb. God, what a golden age of comedy it was. And, of course, the people who were doing it had come up through vaudeville or off the Borscht circuit had really paid their dues. But that offered relief. It did absolutely nothing to improve the level of business or anything else, but it let people relax for mm-hmm. just a little while.
I'm speaking with novelist Kurt Vonnegut. This is KUOW Seattle Afternoon. Is there anything today that still makes you laugh?
Oh, sure. Lots of things do. But a book, after all, takes 3 years. And sure, I could laugh all day today. And I spent a day in a trailer with Rodney Dangerfield one time in Hollywood, and I did nothing but laugh. Is this man just knows wonderful joke after wonderful joke.
This was your film appearance, your only film appearance?
Yeah. Would you like to hear it?
Tell the story of the film appearance. That's a good
Well, I was in back to college with Rodney Dangerfield, who, as a middle-aged man, goes back to college with his son. And I do a cameo. He has to write a paper about me, and he just hires me to write to write the paper. But the great joke he told me is cleanliness jokes. One joke was building away. I've got time to go for about 8 other cleanly jokes. But it was about the cleanly branch of his family, his first cousin's family. His family was clean, but got his first cut. His family was really clean. And the tone was set over there by the grandfather, who was famous, as this man would take 7, 8, 9, 10, sometimes 14 showers or baths a day. And everybody just admired him tremendously. And finally he died. And on the way to the cemetery, the whole funeral cortege went through a car wash. That's funny, and then I'm laughing, and the world's ending.
Hocus Pocus is a story. It's a story told by this professor who ends up in a jail. But the way that it's written is very interesting because he tells us he's going to tell this story, and then he sort of keeps tipping us off to what the story is. It's almost the way that you think sometimes, because you never quite think logically straight through from beginning mm-hmm. to end. You always stop and interrupt yourself and go off on tangents. And in many ways, the book is just full of these tangents. Every other page is off in another direction.
But he's an amateur, for one thing.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to get that style down, to get that writing down?
Well, I love to digress, and a big problem is that I find myself far afield and have to throw a lot of stuff away. There's so much more I want to put in a book than I can, you know. Mm-hmm. The books I do look very simple. They almost look like the Bobbsey twins or something like that. But I work like hell to get that simplicity, and in fact to exclude everything that isn't helpful.
Do you have a handle on your craft now, or does it take an editor or someone to read your stuff also and help put perspective on what you've written?
Well, every book is a different job. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I feel right now as though I'd been fired and I'm out on the street, you know, and all I've done is finish a book. I don't know, my God, what am I going to do now? Where am I going to get to find another job? That's a feeling I have. But the next job will be different. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a formula, but I do try to follow a rule for writing, for storytelling. Is there are only two sorts of things you can include. One advances the action and the other reveals character. And so I think my writing is efficient mm-hmm. that way. No, but each one is... Yeah, I get to put anything I want in a book. And it really is an Adam Smith market, because here I am and people are going to buy it or they're not. Mm-hmm. And I really, Jesse Helms has never sent me a check. Last time I drew a check from the government was when I was a private in the Army.
Do you read your books over, your older books?
No, I don't. But people will quote them to me, and sometimes I'll laugh as I will have forgotten the joke.
Well, that's kind of great.
Yeah, that's nice.
Being able to amuse yourself 20, 30 years later.
Yeah.
Is there a favorite one?
Well, there was one that was very easy, which was the second one. It was called Sirens of Titan, and I had gone, because the magazines had gone bust, and I used to make a lot of money from them, writing short stories. I had a tough 10 years, and... So I hadn't had enough money to write a novel. It's a capitalist problem. You have to accumulate enough capital to take care of you and your family while you create this large artifact. And so for 10 years, I wasn't able to write a novel, and then it all came pouring out. And Dostoevsky had an analogous situation. He was in jail for a while, and when he got out, what did he do? He did Crime and Punishment, the brothers... Karamazov, and mm-hmm. all this stuff came out very fast. And the Sirens of Titan, anyway, mm-hmm. came out very fast. And then they became tough to do again.
Well, I think it was Norman Mailer who said something referring to another author's work and saying, well, I could have written that when I was younger, but now that I'm older, I can't write like that anymore. Do you find that your approach to writing changes as you get older?
Well, I don't know. What happened to my father is surely happening to me. As the older he got, the dumber he got. And I'm 67 years old, and I'd be surprised if that weren't happening to me. Actually, I've lived longer than so many writers. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald, how old was he? He was in his 40s, mm-hmm. in his early 40s when he died. And that's a lucky thing to do if you don't mind death. But I've lived longer than Hemingway now, and just on and on and on. Mm-hmm. You know, I've lived longer than anybody but Tolstoy, I guess, now, because authors don't live very long. I am, incidentally, 2 months older than Mailer, and he treats me as though he were my great uncle.
Kurt Vonnegut's my guest on Seattle Afternoon. You've said there are only two novelists who can be truly proud of movies that were made from their books, mm-hmm. Margaret Mitchell with Gone with the Wind and you with Slaughterhouse-Five.
That's right.
Do you still believe that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm very pleased with it. And George Roy Hill is a close friend. I think it's a swell movie. I don't know. Maybe I've had people come up to me and say, you know, wanting me to agree that it's perfectly terrible and Hill missed the point. Not as far as I'm concerned. I think maybe with Hollywood, people are glad to get anything halfway decent, and I sure as hell did, and Margaret Mitchell did.
Mm-hmm. Was it pleasurable seeing that made into a movie?
Yeah, it was. But a motion picture is a separate work of art, and the guy who did the script, who showed it could be done, because one guy bought Slaughterhouse-Five before it, he'd seen it in Galley.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me up and made me an offer I couldn't refuse on the phone before the book had even been published. And then he decided he'd been a fool, and a writer named Stephen Geller showed him how to do it and wrote this swell script. And then the script was so persuasive, Hill said he would do it. But all my books remain in print. And so you get authors again and again hysterical about movies that have been made based on their books because the movies have become the sole representatives
mm-hmm.
of the books. And the books themselves have been cleaned out of all the bookstores. But my situation is otherwise. And so people can easily check and see what I did. And I think film writers are very different sorts of people, and I certainly respect them. They might as well be musicians or something like that. What they do is so different from what I do.
Are you thinking of a reader when you're writing?
Well, I talked a little about that. It's a matter of psychology. The secret of artistic unity, I've decided, is writing or doing painting or whatever for one person. And if you try to open, and it so happens that I carried the idea of my sister in mind. It's just, she'll laugh like hell at this, and she would think this was pretty bad and all that, so I won't do it. But I think that is a secret of artistic unity. It doesn't much matter who you do it for. I mean, I don't think it's a deep Freudian thing. It's almost a mechanical thing. If you had a favorite high school teacher or whatever, would Miss Jenkins like this or not?
Mm-hmm.
But if you open a If you open the window and make love to the world, nobody's going to be interested. That's the only way you get that unity and that high energy is with one person in mind.